Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us again. You are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, Mike the Porkmeister Parry, and, of course, the irrepressible Leslie Ann Jones, known as Miss Jones to some, known as the rock chick extraordinaire to many others. Miss Jones, how are you this fine day?
I'm absolutely fine, Michael, thank you. How's your day going?
Day's going pretty good. Been hard at work on all sorts of projects and been in and out of studios and setting up show for tomorrow. And I'm not sort of complaining about anything there. I'm glad to be keeping busy. I like a hectic schedule. So in that response, I'm doing rather well. I have to say, Leslie Ann, that there's almost nobody in the showbiz world that you haven't come across during your lifetime. But, of course, the news that greeted us all when we got up last Friday, I think it was that Barbara Windsor had died. And she, I mean, the word national treasure is bandied around all over the place. But I can't imagine anybody in this country not really loving Barbara Windsor because of the cuddly, bubbly, doll-like person she was in the Carry On films. Obviously, she had a second identity in EastEnders many years after that, but most of us will remember for the Carry On persona. And talking to you about it, I learned that I had quite a special day with her once.
I did. It was back in 1990, and she had a little book out, a memoir called The Laughter and Tears of a Cockney Sparrow. Oh, yes. And she was living in Marylebone at the time, in one of those lovely little muse houses that I've always craved.
Yeah.
You know the ones I mean, where they used to keep the horses.
Well, sorry, which part of town was that again?
In Marylebone.
Marylebone, yeah, I know. Well, yeah, I know what you mean. You're absolutely right. The mews terraces, where the houses are now worth £1 million each, were actually the stables for the bigger houses on the other side, weren't they?
Yeah, for the horse and carriage, as everybody had in those days.
Or yeah, brilliant.
As every rich person had in those days.
Yeah.
So she lived in one of those, and off I trot to go and interview her for this nice little book, which was rather sweet, actually. I read it in a sitting, it wasn't very long. And she greeted me like a long-lost friend. She was absolutely charming.
Was this at her house? You went to her house?
Yeah, in those days one did, didn't we?
I find that strange. I say, if I was going to do an interview and I'd written a book, anywhere near as successful as the books you've written, and I wanted to talk about it, I wouldn't do it in my house. I wouldn't have people in my house. I would go to a bar that was very expensive and get the person interviewing me to pay for it. And in fact, when I wrote the book I had, which got into the bestseller list, which was called There's an Awful Lot of Bubbly in Brazil, we did about half a dozen interviews, and Alan Brazil would only ever do them in bars because he said, I'm wasting my time sitting there talking to somebody when I really want to have a drink and get convivial, you know. So they were all done in very expensive bars. Anyway, please go on.
Yeah, I think back then there was a kind of thing that we went to people's houses and you were welcomed into people's homes. And also there was the privacy thing. If you were recognisable, rather well-known, people would come up to your table or to the bar and they'd want an autograph. And nowadays they'd want a selfie. Mm-hmm. And I think, if you're going to get down and have an intimate conversation with a journalist, it's actually easier to do it at home. Not that you would get that now. Anyway, that's what we did.
But anyway, can I just interrupt there? Because it's such a good point you've made. I don't think it was yourself, but I read about somebody who did exactly what you did and went to the Westminster flat of Cilla Black and had three bottles of champagne with her during a convivial afternoon in which, it was just a great interview. So you're absolutely right. It's a way to do it, isn't it?
Yeah, get into their house. That was always the brief in those days, wasn't it? That's why we were sent on doorsteps often.
Exactly, yeah.
And people would invite you in for a cup of tea. Mm. Anyway, back to Barbara.
Yes.
So there we are having a nice interview and got on really well. And she made me lunch and we carried on chatting throughout the afternoon. And
What lunch?
She made egg mayonnaise. She made it herself to have on crumpets. And she put chopped spring onion into the egg mayonnaise, which I really don't like. But I ate it anyway, just to be polite. You know, yes. My mum always said, just eat what's put in front of you.
Yes, and, that's right. Unless it makes you feel ill.
Yes, I know. So I did eat it. Anyway. Yeah. Her partner at the time, who wasn't Scott, her husband, because this was in 1990, and I don't think they got married until 2000. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But it was somebody else. And he came home anyway. And then we all went off out to dinner on to some restaurant on Marylebone.
It wasn't Ronnie Knight. It wasn't the gangster.
No, it wasn't him. No. But he was quite quiet, didn't say a lot. He was charming. But, of course, she held the table. It was all her stories and her
Did
gags.
Did you give me a drink while you were eating your egg mayonnaise?
No, we had a cup of tea. Then we had some wine over dinner in the evening. It was just such a nice occasion. Yeah. And she wrote... I've got a copy of her book. She wrote me a lovely message, really long message, which I posted on Twitter, actually, just saying how much she was looking forward to reading my book. So, you know, charm to the tips of her fingers.
Yeah, she was absolutely,
absolutely lovely.
Yeah. She was described by one of her longest friends, who's a Coronation Street actress, and I've forgotten her name now, with long dark hair. She was also in Carry On Cleopatra. Do you know the actress I'm talking about? Can you envisage her?
Oh, vaguely. I was pretty young when those came out.
But she starred in Coronation Street years on. I can't remember. I think she played like Thelma or something in Coronation Street. But she said they started at stage school together when they were 16, right? And she said Barbara was like a little toy because she was so petite. She had size 1 foot and used to give her shoes away to the children, you know, aged about 5 or 6 of all her friends.
Yeah. Yeah. She was charming. Very, very small. But she packed a punch. Mm. I think the Carry On films, they'd be so politically incorrect now, wouldn't they? You couldn't get away with making films like that.
No.
And also the character she played, Peggy Mitchell on EastEnders, you know, she was always whacking people.
She was.
And I don't think you could get away with that now.
No, probably not. I when I saw all the tributes to, you're absolutely right. You know, take that, bang, take that.
Get smack. Out of my pub.
Yeah, get out of my pub. Yeah, no. Kind of, anyway, there you go. But, excuse me, clearly a legend in her own lifetime. Talking about legends, Miss Jones, I mean,
yes.
Whatever happened in the Johnny Depp, Amber Rudd.
Amber Rudd will be pleased with you.
He'll be very pleased with me, that's right. Yeah, sorry, Ms. Rudd. In the Amber Heard trial, you know, and it was sensational and all that, I couldn't imagine that Johnny Depp would have any credibility then for the rest of his life. And yet, Sauvage is a man's aftershave promoted by Dior.
Well, women don't tend to use aftershave, do we?
No, they don't. But hang on, they sometimes buy it for their boyfriends at Christmas
true.
Kind of stuff, yeah? And Dior, the French company who are promoting it, say they couldn't care less what happened in an English court about Johnny Depp. As far as they're concerned, he is great for their image. Do you find that a bit odd?
It's a very dodgy message going on here. First of all, the ad paid him about between $3 and $5 million. So the amount of money he had to pay the Sun, which was, I think, 630,000 in legal fees, pounds, that was easily covered, wasn't it? I personally think it would be very sensible for Dior to sever links with him because I think it'll damage the brand in the long run. He has been found guilty of being a wife beater. And I think what it is that these fashion houses, they live in a fantasy world, almost as though the laws and rules of the real world don't apply to them. Mm-hmm. So they are retaining him as the face of the fragrance. But I think what they're thinking is we hedge our bets here because he's not just big in the UK, he's big all over the world.
Oh,
and the attitude, so the attitude towards Johnny Depp is going to be very different in, say, for example, Eastern Europe than it is here.
You're so right. And by the way, you don't have to even get to Eastern Europe. Apparently, the French couldn't care less. You know, the French are all sort of, oh, it's Johnny Depp and all that. But so what? It happened in an English court. And much to the discredit of French society, and you've lived in France, apparently, you know, abuse against women in France is not taken as seriously as it is in this country.
Yeah, well, that's horrifying. But I mean, these companies, as I said, they do live in a bubble.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that film, The Devil Wears Prada. You know, they're used to controversy and they love controversy.
Yeah.
Do you remember his former partner, Kate Moss, the model? She was dropped by Burberry and Chanel after her News of the World cocaine scandal.
that's right.
But it didn't kill her career. It added to her appeal, and she became the darling of the non-high street, the high-end fashion houses. And I think Dior are taking that same all publicity is good publicity stance.
Really? God, that's amazing. Because, of course, I remember the Kate Moss stuff. She was involved with that Pete Doherty guy at the time, wasn't she? You know, a man whose flame sort of lit, fired and burned out within about 2 years. And he was seen as, like, cool, wasn't he? And there was Kate Moss with him and all that kind of stuff. But I just don't get it, you know. Is it because we've been brought up on false hypocrisy? Oh, she snorted cocaine, therefore she's a bad girl. Or do we accept that, well, half the world in her circle of friends now snorts it, so what's the big deal?
Well, the City of London snorts it. Yes, you know, exactly. I think it's much more prevalent than we know. But yeah. I think the other thing about this Dior Sauvage is the name of the product. It's very worrying because it means savage, it means violent.
Right.
And given that he's just been found guilty of wife beating,
yes.
I think this is a very dodgy product to put his name to.
You know, I hadn't worked that out. I suspected Sauvage had something to do with Savage. So, yeah, you've got a man there posing in his sultry, literally sultry, best, handsome, appealing sort of look. Savage written all over his head, just been convicted of being a wife beater. That's a very odd combination of a promotional tool for a product, isn't it?
It is. And also the internet searches for Sauvage increased by 23% after his conviction.
Well,
I mean, people need to think about this a little bit more, I think.
Well, you may well be right. Anyway, from that rather dark episode that we've just talked about, let me light your life up, Miss Jones, because you're not going to believe this. You, of course, will have been the first probably to find out that Mariah Carey's festive single, All I Want for Christmas Is You, has finally hit the top of the charts, but it's 26 years after its release. It only got to number two in 1994. I've looked this up, and it lost out to Stay Another Day, or whatever it is, by some guys called E17.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's at number one. It's been streamed 10.8 million times. Mariah Carey herself said, "We are keeping the Christmas."
She's Mariah, by the way. We ought to pronounce her name properly,
all right.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Miss Jones. Yeah, thank you.
That's all right.
In an English pronunciation. Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey. And and she's got to... yeah, yourself, Miss Jones. And she's got done one. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this, right, is because I'm not sure if I have told you, I have actually made a Mariah Carey version. What are you after now?
Yes, Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey version.
Yeah, that's the one.
Of this very song, right? All I Want for Christmas Is You. Have I told you this?
You did throw it in last week, yeah.
Did I? Yeah, well, I'll throw it in again. So I'm one of, this is all to do with the fact that I work occasionally for Jeremy Vine on Five, okay? Which I enjoy very much. Jeremy's a great guy, Channel 5 programme and all that. Join the panel. It's great. And so I got a note saying, hi, Mike, we're going to do a compilation single. Obviously, it's got to be done outside of a studio these days. Could you possibly film yourself singing a bit of Mariah Carey? And they sent me all the lyrics. And they actually sent me, you won't believe it, the written music. And the lady who did it, lovely lady, she said, I'll send you the music as well, just in case you want to sort of alternate your voice to go up and down as the musical notes.
Do you read notated music?
Well, I thought to myself, this is a great irony, because you and I obviously often talk about two gentlemen called John Lennon and Paul McCartney, right, obviously.
Yeah.
And, of course, they couldn't read or write music, could they? So,
Elton can. Elton absolutely can. He went to the Royal College of Music.
Elton John?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
Paul
John
McCartney
Lennon.
Doesn't read. Oh, sorry, I thought you said Elton John.
No,
I beg your pardon.
I should have said John Lennon, John Paul McCartney. But I can imagine that Elton John does, yeah, from listening to his records. But how can you become such a brilliant, you know, innovator of, you know, writing songs and music and all that, and not read music? So how, the guys at JV5 thought that I could read music when the two stars of the Beatles couldn't. I don't know. However, I managed to get...
Get to the point, Michael.
I'm going to get to the point. Yeah, you're always telling me this to get to the point. You're telling me I ramble and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you do a little bit, yeah.
Let me tell you, you know, I get quite a few, you know, responsive messages from the listeners out there saying, you know, right on there, Porky, and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, point of my story is that I managed to access a studio with a backdrop of London in Dickensian times and snow falling, okay? And I was wearing...
Where did you get that from?
Well, I did it at the radio studios I work at. They very kindly, you know, allowed me a facility to put that on the backdrop.
Oh, a bit of CGI going on.
It's better than that, actually. It's more sophisticated than that. It was just a very, you know, up-to-date studio with cameras and all that kind of stuff.
Does it get more sophisticated than CGI?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to ask my friends at Talk Radio.
Or is that a technical question?
I think it sounds like a technical question to me. But anyway, I also had my Santa elf hat on, okay?
So
I can imagine that you can't wait to see that, okay?
I'm gagging.
Miss Jones, please, you know, I mean, if you wanted to...
I mean, I'm gagging to see it. Not that I'm gagging into a bucket.
You know, you could have said, I can't wait or something
all right,
like that.
I can't,
you know
what I mean? Wait. It means the same thing as gagging. It does.
I don't think it does, Miss Jones. You know, I've heard the expression, I'm gagging, used in quite a different context over the years. You know?
Well, keep it clean. It's a family show.
Yeah, keep it clean. It's a family show. Right. Now then, what I was going to say to you was, let me see. What was I going to say? Oh, yes, that's right. Anyway, so all I do is about 15 seconds here, 20 seconds there, something like that, okay? And then they're going to put them all together as a compilation, a bit like Band-Aid, you see what I mean?
Oh, right. So who are you playing in Band-Aid? Are you the kind of cool...
No, I'm not. The thing is...
I know. I can hear what you're saying, yeah. But I'm just wondering if you're going to come on like Paul Young, you know, sort of all cool and or be a bit Boy George about it.
I did. Or, no. I did 4 15-minute clips, okay? 15-second, I should say.
I was going to say, yeah, God.
Because I worked out that if it's a 3-minute song and there's about, there's probably about, I would say, about 12 or 15 different presenters been asked to do it, then if I bagged 15 seconds, that would be 1/12. That would be pretty good. So I sent them 4 15-second clips. But it's all great stuff. I do the opening line, I do a middle line, and I do the end, okay? But anyway, look, as soon as I get it, you will be the first to get a private viewing, Miss Jones, okay?
I'm going to stay up all night and wait for it.
Yeah, you see, being sarcastic again.
No, I'm really not. I'm being genuinely...
I do, you know, any time I move into the world of show business, you know, you just think that, you know, what's he talking about? I know better. Yeah, I know. Don't worry.
I'm not being cynical. I'm being enthusiastic. Yeah. I'm supporting you,
yeah.
Well, my podcast partner, yeah, in your showbiz endeavours. Well, and I'm right behind you, Michael.
Thank you very much indeed. Talking about showbiz endeavours, did you have a lot to do with Jim Davidson? And the reason I ask is because I found out the other day Jim Davidson's now 67.
He looks older. He looks a lot older, doesn't he?
Well, I haven't seen a picture of him recently, but he looked about 67 when I used to see him when he was about 45, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, 20 years ago, yeah. I went to a 21st birthday party down in Somerset somewhere years ago, and he was there. I tell you who else was there. It was Simon Kinnersley. You've vanished.
No, I'm here. Sorry. Yes.
Oh, you are there. Oh, okay.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I kind of don't like him very much. He's a bit controversial, bit of a throwback, a dinosaur. Okay. Well, he makes jokes about women, ethnic minorities, homosexuals, the disabled, and he doesn't see anything wrong in that. He's very unapologetic.
Have you been drinking, Miss Jones?
No, I haven't. No, not yet.
The reason you lost me a minute ago is because I'm having a nice glass of Merlot whilst we're
He's reconstructed, isn't he? And he's just not my cup of tea, I'm afraid.
Well, yes, I can accept all that. And I agree with you. I think some of it is a really hard listen. However, in a way, I quite admire his bravery because there was a story around in the last 48 hours that 75% of the comedians who are paid quite a lot of money by the BBC are very left-wing. And all they do is, enjoy free airtime to mock the Conservative government and Boris Johnson and any right-wing MPs. But the left never get it. Now, Jim Davis, at least, is an out-and-out Conservative supporter, and he makes that absolutely clear. You know, he calls himself a Thatcherite. I believed in Thatcherite policies. I believed in Mrs. Thatcher. I want to stand up and say that. That side of him I admire because he's going against the grain of his profession. You would admit, wouldn't you, that most comedians have to be sort of left-wing to get on the BBC these days?
Well, they do, because it swung the other way from Alf Garnett, didn't it? I mean, Alf Garnett, my mother would not have on in the house. Yeah. I knew it was a sitcom and not a comedian getting up. But the lines he was fed, was it Warren Mitchell, the actor?
Well, yeah, but you see, I think your mother must have misread that with the greatest respect to your mother, because Warren Mitchell was the actor. The text was written by Johnny Spate. Johnny Spate was a born, dye-in-the-wool socialist who tried to expose the excesses of the right by creating this character, Warren Mitchell, as an, you know, an obscene, horrible, bigoted individual.
That I understand, but it was offensive.
Yeah, but it was funny as well. Because
if you didn't know it was ironic, which obviously my mother didn't know.
No, she didn't know.
If you didn't know that, you found it offensive. But he was modelled on an American character who was called Archie Bunker. That's where the idea originally came from.
That's right. No, you're absolutely right. And of course, the other star of that show was Tony Booth, who was father of Sherry Booth, who was Tony Blair's wife.
Exactly.
Yeah, so
But we won't hold that against any of them.
We won't hold against that, no, absolutely. Once again, don't hold it against me. Honestly, Miss Jones, you know, these
Come
little
on.
Double meanings, you know. Now, listen, I'll tell you what I was going to tell you about. I was going to tell you about the fact that Debenhams and all these big stores are closing down, okay? And we know that's going to happen, and it's very, very sad. But along with those stores closing down, the beauty floor will close down, the beauty section. And you must have spent hours and hours and hours. Not that you needed to, of course, Miss Jones, because you were a true beauty of Fleet Street. I'm suggesting that you needed to plaster your face to make it look better or anything like that. But the point is that I used to love those beauty floors. When I was a younger man, it didn't matter where the beauty store was in the shop. I always made sure that one way or another I'd walk through it, because the girls behind the counters of all the big name cosmetics were always so glamorous and so beautiful.
Well, of course, because they had all that slap all over them. I wonder what they looked like without it.
Golly, that's really nice, isn't it? You know, let's defend our fellow working woman, shall we, Miss Jones, eh?
Well, it's true, isn't it? I mean, you just said to me I didn't need very much makeup.
Yeah.
You know, when we're young and we've got sort of smooth skin and all of that, we don't need very much. We need it as we get older. So there was all that sort of paradox of young, glamorous girls caked to the eyelashes selling the products to older women who actually do need them.
So harsh. Don't you think that a woman
it's true.
A woman of any age needs lipstick, doesn't she?
We don't need lipstick, do you? I read
a
the other day.
A woman of any age wears lipstick, doesn't she?
Well, you don't need, nobody needs lipstick. But listen to this. Lipstick sales since the beginning of the first pandemic are down 40%. Guess why? Because we're all wearing masks when we go out. So if you wear lipstick, it all sticks to the inside of the mask, so nobody's wearing it anymore.
Well, also, you can't see a woman's lips, so they don't need to be looking ruby red. And B, you can't kiss them. So there's not much point, is there? You know what I mean?
No, but I tell you what, all that swabbing and dabbing, it had to go, didn't it? Because it's not very hygienic.
No,
we can't try on bits of makeup. We can't test the things anymore.
No.
So they're going to have to resort to AI, artificial intelligence, which is a whole different way of selling makeup. I think it's all gone online. People are ordering this stuff sight unseen. You know, you can order a few testers and try things out at home, but the business has to change in the long term, because try before you buy has gone. The department store is on the way out.
Yes,
and I'm afraid that normal life as we knew it for so long is not coming back.
Oh, God, I used to love walking through those beauty departments, the counters. You know, there was just beautiful smell of perfume all over the place.
Mm.
These gorgeous ladies with long tumbling hair. Or
did you ever score one of those gorgeous ladies?
Yes, with one in Northern Ireland, believe it or not.
Oh, did you? What was the shop?
Golly, I can't remember, because when you shopped in Northern Ireland, you had to go through a military gate to get into the shopping centre. And you concentrate.
Well, that'd put you off.
Well, it would have done, yeah. But I can't quite remember what it was called there. I mean, many other stores I've been into, like Debenhams and what were the other ones? Frasers, yeah? Were they Frasers, yeah?
Army and Navy or something. Was it Army and Navy?
There was an Army and Navy, that's right, in Victoria Street on the way up to Victoria Station one time. And I did find it quite alluring. But anyway, there you are. Sorry, just getting back to Jim Davidson, because I remember now one of the reasons why I asked you. Our old colleague, Mr. Roger Taverner, I was the news editor of the Daily Express, and he was the show's editor. And Jim Davidson was launching something on a Sunday morning. I don't know why it was a Sunday morning, but it was launching something. And Roger went out then, came back. Had a great story. Jim Davidson had gone bankrupt and had moved back in with his mother. But it turned out later on not to be true.
It was a great line. Yeah, Sunday for Monday. That is a good line.
It certainly was. So I leapt on it. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for tuning in to Life on Planet Porky with, of course, myself and Miss Jones. Miss Jones, what report, please? What news back on the worldwide sales of the book? Who killed John Lennon?
Well, it's going great guns in America. I've had some fantastic reviews through this week.
Fantastic.
And I tell you who got in touch with me as a result was Martin Dunn. Do you remember Dunn?
Of course I do. Of course I do. Martin Dunn, for the benefit of our millions of listeners. I first met Martin when he was the Sun correspondent in New York and I was the Daily Express correspondent in New York, okay? I went on to have a quite a successful career, did quite well, like you'd have and all that. Martin went on to become like king of the world in New York. He ended up being chauffeured around in a stretch limo as editor-in-chief of the New York Daily News.
Yes, he was. And before that, he was editor of the Boston Globe.
He was. That's right.
So he made his way up the tree.
Sorry, it wasn't the Boston Globe. It was the Boston Herald. There were two papers in Boston.
Easy mistake to make. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he did. And then his wife tragically died. And he jacked in the newspaper world because I think there was some guilt attached there, maybe, you know. A lot of his life, I would say 80% of his life at that point, was work, was flying to and fro and being away from home a lot of the time. And he reshaped his life after he lost his wife. And now he makes films and lives in upstate New York.
Right. Well, you know, I'm delighted he's getting on. What did he say to you in his message?
He heard the Graham Norton interview on BBC Radio 2, bizarrely.
Brilliant.
So that reaches far and wide. I didn't realise that had a transatlantic audience at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me this. Are you a tartan tart, Miss Jones?
It's just the way I walk, darling.
Well, yes. Oh, you see, once again, you know, down to the basic levels of it. What I meant was, because I keep up with everything, tartan is now the in thing for this Christmas, this winter, whatever you want to call it. But I can't bear wearing tartan. And it's no reflection on my friends in Scotland and all that kind of stuff. In fact, I've got a tam o'shanter. I've got a true tartan tam o'shanter, which I wear when I go up there, if it's the Edinburgh Festival or something. But I don't think tartan suits anybody.
Well, okay, when we were little girls, we always had a nice little red tartan kilt or a tartan scarf. Rupert the Bear had a tartan scarf, if you recall.
There's
never been anything wrong with a little bit of tartan. They're trying to say now, aren't they, that we are appropriating tartan and it belongs in Scotland and we have no right to wear it. How bloody stupid is that? We've always worn a bit of tartan and I actually quite like it. There are lots of different patterns, you know, because of all the clans having their own particular one. I quite like the greeny, purpley one, which I don't know the name of.
Right.
But there's the Black Watch, isn't there? And there are various, they've all got their own names and so on. Look, if it turns you on, wear a bit of tartan.
Yeah. Well,
I bet you wear tartan boxers without anybody knowing.
Miss Jones, whatever my mode in undergarments is not for public consumption, thank you. Only you could sort of bring that up, of course.
I might have had a glimpse when you didn't tuck your shirt in probably once.
No, listen, we're not going there. We're not going there. Excuse me.
All right.
Now, listen, I told you I was going to talk to you about. We often talk about Fleet Street colleagues and, you know, we get very good feedback. People like to hear about our experiences in Fleet Street. I'm going to mention to you a name who became quite notorious, really, Andy Coulson. And Andy Coulson was the editor of the News of the World. He left that job and went to work for David Cameron as his head of press or chief information officer, something like that. He left there then when the phone hacking scandal started swirling around his head, and Andy ended up in jail. He was sentenced to 18 months and he served 5 months, and he's written quite a long piece about that experience in a publication which I picked up today. And I have to say, it must, talk about being at the height of your profession, because in those days, the News of the World was the biggest selling newspaper in Europe, I think, and ended up in jail. That must have been quite a shock.
Well, it must have been. We all knew Andy well, and look, he got the biggest opportunity of his life, didn't he, when David Cameron came knocking, and I think he was quite nervous about it at the time, and everybody said, you know, come on, it's a massive opportunity, just go for it.
Yeah.
And of course, it was a great thing for his contacts, wasn't it, to have one of their own closest colleagues right inside number 10.
Of course.
So it couldn't, how could it possibly go wrong? But of course it did.
Yeah.
It went down the toilet big style. Look, he paid his dues, he served his time, and now he's obviously reflecting on how he spent different parts of his life, and and now he wants to make sense of it. And I think it's absolutely acceptable that he would want to come clean and explain what happened and why he did it.
Yeah, no, I accept all that. But David Cameron was a complete fool to take him on. Because Andy left the News of the World because the mists of doubt were starting to gather about phone hacking, OK? Everybody denied it all the time. A lot of our colleagues over the years were then at the News of the World and they were denying everything. And then Andy left. Now, the first thing that David Cameron said to him when he was introduced by George Osborne, I believe, the then Chancellor, right, was, Andy, is there anything that's going to come back and bite you on the bum from this, you know, phone hacking investigation, which appears to be going on? And Andy allegedly said, no, nothing. Whereas he was proven by a court of law to have been, you know, very influential in it. So that in itself was a sort of... well, you know, where would you put yourself in that sort of situation? I don't know.
It's a big lesson to learn, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If there's anything, it's going to come out however long it takes.
Exactly.
You wouldn't put yourself in a position of such high profile terror in a way. I mean, why would you set yourself up? You would just slink away and, you know, stuck milk in Tesco's or something, wouldn't you?
Yeah, sure. I totally agree. Anyway, he tells a story in this piece about his time in prison. He says, on the first night in prison, I'm queuing up for a plate of food. And he said previously how nervous he was, having never been in prison before. And he's in Belmarsh, which is one of the highest security prisons in this country. He said, I'm queuing for a plate of food. And the bloke behind the servery gives me an extra potato, because apparently your food is, like, you know, the same for everybody. You know what I mean? He said, I'm giving you that, mate, because I used to read the News of the World. I used to love that paper. Thank you very much. And Andy says, I thought to myself, this is literally the first benefit I've had from having been the editor of the News of the World for a number of years. An extra potato from the servery at Belmarsh. And doesn't that put life into perspective? How one minute you're up there and the next minute you're down, eh?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, Piers Morgan has on his Twitter thing, you know, where you have a little description on Twitter of who you are, what you do. And he says something like, one minute you're cock of the walk, next minute you're a feather duster.
I know, you're absolutely right. I've seen that.
And I think that's about the size of it, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
One minute you're up, next minute you're down. And that can happen to all of us. So there, but for the grace of God.
Yes, no, I totally agree with you. I've seen a very disturbing story, Leslie Ann. I've had quite a big interest in Diana, Princess of Wales, ever since I broke the news to the world that she had died in France, you know, and I'll keep telling people that because I'm very proud of it. It's one of the highlights of my career. But I also had a huge amount of respect for her and what she had to put up with. And we're all seeing it again now in a TV series called The Crown. And there's a big row about whether that should be treated as, you know, historical fact or whether it's fiction. But this story really bothered me. Ghouls cashing in on the Crown by selling locks of Diana's hair, a wedding cake slice and her funeral order of service. There's been a long, thriving trade in royal memorabilia, but today business is booming on an almost unprecedented scale thanks to the new season of The Crown, which focuses on her turbulent marriage to Prince Charles. If you go onto social media and search Princess Diana, there's all sorts of offers of artifacts allegedly attached to Diana on eBay and all this kind of stuff. And I find that so ghoulish and frankly disgusting. I just can't handle it.
Well, who had that lock of hair in the first place? Who had that slice of wedding cake?
Yeah.
This has got to be somebody who knew her intimately, personally, who went to the wedding, whatever.
Yeah.
So who is touting that tat? And why would you want it? Why would you part with money to have a bit of her old hair in your house? What, unless you're a scientist and you can try and extract the DNA from it and make somebody else out of it or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, why would you want it?
Well, there's a picture here of a frame with a picture of Diana, alleged signature of Diana's, and then in a separate little frame within the frame, a heirloom. And it says, one US dealer sparked outrage when he sold these strands of hair for nearly £300 in October. He had 10 pages of documents, which he insisted proved the strands were authentic, with Diana said to have taped them to a book inscribed My Lock Diana 1995. But the book has never been produced. Which mad person would buy that, believing it's Diana's hair? Hmm?
Well, how are you going to prove that? Where's the DNA that you can match that up with?
No, there's another one here, and you won't believe this. This is even more disgusting. A part-eaten wedding cake on sale for £180. Charles and Diana donated the top tier of their wedding cake to the Duchy of Cornwall Estate Office in South London. A staff member's daughter is now selling a partly nibbled slice of the fruitcake left complete with original cream cheese frosting and a rose of yellow icing.
I mean, oh, for goodness sake. I mean, that cake could be anybody's for a start. That could be some old Christmas cake that someone's dug out the back of a freezer that's been in there for the last 15 years. I mean, if you fall for that, you'll fall for anything.
I agree. It's pretty damned horrible, isn't it? Now then, Miss Jones, nearly forgot your name.
That's me.
I'm sorry.
What's my name again?
My concentration factor. You won't believe this. I was once interviewing David Cameron, and I swear to you, I forgot who he was. Honest to God. I'm staring across the desk, you know, in a radio studio at him, and he's got this really pompous look on his face. He was not Prime Minister at the time. He was leader of the opposition, but he was doing the rounds of radio stations, you know, trying to whip up support and all that. And I was saying, and honestly, it just, I could not remember his name. You know,
Your mind went blank. Had you come straight from the pub?
No, I swear to you, no, I hadn't. I used to do a show in those days between 10 and 1 in the morning. So this
had you been home the night before?
Yes, absolutely. No, there was, believe me, it wasn't my fault. But I'm staring across at him, and he'd done the usual thing. He'd walked into the studio. And somebody had given him a mug which said Talk Sport on it, who I worked for then, you know. And I said, oh, hello, Mr. Cameron, you know, because I remembered his name to start off with, you know. And I shook hands with him. He said, yeah, hi, Matt. I said, it's very good of you to come in and give us your time. He said, any time for Talk Sport, any time, you know. He then tried to pretend he was a football fan, but later he couldn't remember who he supported because West Ham and Aston Villa, as you know, Leslie Ann, through your father's genius at being a football reporter, both playing the same colours. One minute he was an Aston Villa fan, and sometime later he was a West Ham fan because somebody must have just given him a picture of the shirt or something. You know what I mean?
Oh, well, that's very funny.
Yeah,
you can never kid a kidder. No. So you've just always got to come clean about stuff like that.
Yeah, but actually, I'm not joking. I was standing across the desk at him and I was thinking, I can't remember this guy's name. And I just had to keep, you know, when it's so impolite not to refer to somebody as OK, David, or thank you, Mr. Cameron, or now leader of the opposition. I couldn't remember any of his titles or what he was. And I think that's because he was actually so boring. You know what I mean? No, seriously, nothing he said was interesting. It was just, you know, straight off the old, you know, tongue, tripping off the tongue, you know, just trying to give us. Now, listen, talking about people in jail, as we have done about Mr. Coulson, who, of course, now is out of jail and making a new career for himself as a consultant, I think, in some consultancy. By the way, when I first met him, I had just gone to work for The Sun, and in the same week, he left and went to the Daily Mail as a showbiz editor. And I remember as he was leaving, one of the bosses at The Sun said, the Daily Mail, Andy, won't last 5 minutes. And funny enough, he didn't. He returned very soon and went to the News of the World as associate editor of Bracket Showbiz or something. Anyway, that's for another day. So, talking about jail, Miss Jones, I do ramble a bit sometimes, don't I?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, get on with it.
I've got to get on with it. What about Ghislaine? And I'm told that's the proper pronunciation. Is it Ghislaine? Ghislaine?
No, it's Ghislaine.
Ghislaine. Okay. Okay, Ghislaine. So Ghislaine Maxwell is in this top security prison in Brooklyn, one of the five boroughs of New York. She applied for bail when she was first taken in after being found in her remote palatial mansion in New Hampshire in the northeast of America. And she offered up $3 million in bail and the judge rejected it. They've just put in a new offer of $30 million for her to be bailed pending the trial, which won't take place probably until sort of autumn of next year. And $25 million of that has been put up by a man who describes herself as her boyfriend.
Well, what? No, that's wrong, because it turns out he's her husband. He's a guy called Scott Borgerson, and they got married at some point.
Right. How did
they met? I tell you where they met. How do I know this? I can't remember who told me now, but this is true. They met doing some speaking engagement connected to ocean preservation about 6 years ago. And they've been together ever since. And he's put up, you're quite right, the $25 million. Her brothers, Kevin and Ian, have put up the other $5 million. I smell a rat here, actually, because Ghislaine has a French passport.
Right.
There is no extradition treaty between the US and France. So they put up this bail money. She gets out of jail. She disappears off to France for Christmas.
Yeah.
And that's the last we see of her. She never comes back to face her trial. So that's what I think is going on here.
Isn't that the route that that disgraceful paedophile film producer took?
Oh, which is...
the guy, Polanski, Roman Polanski.
Roman Polanski, yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. He went to Switzerland, of course, didn't he?
But I think he flew into Paris first. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, probably did. He can't go back to America, but there's no extradition treaty. So that's what I think is happening here.
Yeah. Well,
and if they... Well, she's in the Metropolitan Detention Centre, isn't she?
That's right, yeah.
Anyway, if the judge falls for this, then, there's no hope.
I think it's more sinister. You see, I've always said from the moment she went into jail, I said she will never, ever appear in court. One way or another, nobody amongst the rich and the powerful that she was dealing with and supplying young girls to, allegedly, could let her get into court in case they get access to the little black book, okay? I always said she'll never testify in court. One way or another, she won't. And I expected her by now to have been bumped off in jail in the same way that,
Jeffrey
Epstein, yeah. But this could be another route. But what I'm saying is, anybody who puts up 25 million bail to get somebody out of jail must have a very, very serious reason for wanting that person to be released from custody.
Yeah, I agree. He's a tech entrepreneur, apparent husband. Her apparent husband.
Yeah.
So he's obviously loaded. $25 million is not very much to him. But yes, I believe you. There is a reason why they don't want her in court testifying.
Absolutely.
So what's going to happen to her when she gets to France?
Well, on the basis that truth can sometimes be stranger than fiction, and that if you cross, for instance, Mr. Putin, the leader of Russia, you quite often end up falling off the 17th floor of a very high building. I believe something like that could possibly happen to her.
Well, let's not wish that on her.
I'm not wishing that on her. I'm not wishing that on her. What I'm saying is, I think she's become a huge liability to an awful lot of rich and powerful people in this world who are going to do their utmost, bridled with their enormous wealth, to make sure she doesn't appear in court. And that means, Miss Jones, I was right from the very start.
Yes, I agree. So, it could be that they've all stuck in some of the money for this bail option.
It's exactly what I'm saying.
Because they want her off the face of the earth.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So, five very rich men put in $5 million each. They put it in the account of the so-called husband or whatever his name is. And the judge is more likely to accept a pledge from her husband than from a stranger.
And, which is why she's got married suddenly.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I just don't understand it. Anyway,
it's very dodgy. Anyway, I guess time will tell.
Time will tell. Listen, were your parents ever a fan of The Archers, the radio series?
My mother did used to watch it. My father used to tell a story of him coming home from work once as a very young man. They were only in their 20s.
Yes.
And my mother met him at the door in floods of tears, inconsolable, and he said, "What's the matter with you?" Thinking that something had happened to one of us.
Yeah.
And she said, "Mrs. Archer's dead." So I think she really believed in it. She really fell for it. It was the first soap, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, it was, yeah. It was radio, by the way, so she couldn't have been watching
it. Yeah, I know that. No. I know she wasn't watching it. I know that it's on the radio, duh. But it was a soap opera nonetheless, or still is.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. But you did say, I'm sorry, Miss Jones, in case you think I'm being a pedant, you said that your mother had been watching it when she opened the door to your father.
Freudian slip, darling.
No, it's not a Freudian slip. What it is...
Or it was just a slip then.
No. In this modern day and age, when we do radio, it comes with pictures as well, doesn't it? So you have every right to assume it might have been the same in those days. So
yeah, but it's so long ago. It's before my time, you see.
I'm getting you off the hook there.
Listen, thank you very much.
One last question. Legendary singer Dusty Springfield was so broke in the 1970s that she entered contests impersonating herself, but lost them.
That's hilarious. A lot of people rave about Dusty Springfield's voice and say that she was the artist of all time and so on. I never got it. That's a bit Emperor's New Clothes for me.
Really? Yeah. I liked some of her songs, you know, because they were quite good songs, and I quite liked her, you know, quite rough, coarse voice and all that kind of stuff. But I read a profile on her a couple of years back when it was the anniversary of her death. Apparently she was a very, very difficult person to deal with, you know, would always get sort of drunk and refuse to do things and that kind of stuff. But
I know a few women of a certain age who had, let's call them liaisons with her.
Yeah, I think that was the best kept secret in showbiz at the time. But I think it's very much a factor of the history of Ms. Dusty Springfield.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that at all. Live and let live. That's what I say all the time. Yeah. Right, Ms. Jones, thank you very much indeed for joining me in this verbal, what can I call it? A verbal feast, yes?
Exchange, a smorgasbord, a discourse.
Exactly, all of that.
You and I banging on, basically.
All that, yeah. But I mean, you know, people are being very nice about it. We get some very nice responses, so we'll keep going, keep doing it. Christmas is coming closer. By the time we do the next podcast, we may well know whether Tier 3 and Tier 2 have been swapped round and we're all being put into prison again. That is for next time. Meanwhile, folks, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Miss Jones. We'll be in touch again very soon.
Keep it cool.
Now, it's at number one. It's been streamed 10.8 million times. Maria Carey herself said, "We are keeping the Christmas."
She's Mariah, right. By the way. We ought to pronounce her name properly.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Miss Jones. Yeah. Thank you.
That's all right.
In an English pronunciation, Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey, and and she's got to yourself, Miss Jones, and she's got some what? Now, the reason I'm telling you all this, right, is because I'm not sure if I have told you, I have actually made a Mariah Carey version. What are you laughing at?
Yes, Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey version.
Yeah, that's the one.
Of this very song, right? All I Want for Christmas Is You. Have I told you this?
You did throw it in last week, yeah.
Did I? Yeah, well, I'll throw it in again. You won't believe this. I was once interviewing David Cameron, and I swear to you, I forgot who he was. Honest to God, I'm staring across the desk, you know, in a radio studio at him, and he's got this really pompous look on his face. He was not Prime Minister at the time, he was leader of the opposition, but he was doing the rounds of radio stations, you know, trying to whip up support and all that. And I was saying, and honestly, it just, I could not remember his name, you know.
Your mind went blank. Had you come straight from the pub?
Tell me this, are you a tartan tart? Miss Jones.
It's just the way I walk, darling.
Well, yes, you see, once again, you know, down to the basic levels of it.